Summer, dozens of faithful Latter-day Saints traveled to Huntsville, Utah, a small Mormon town of great beauty in Ogden Valley, some 10 miles east of Ogden, to visit the boyhood home of David O. McKay, ninth president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. McKay is considered one of 20th century Mormondom's most beloved figures. However, most visitors are unaware that the old Huntsville farmhouse was also the childhood home of Fawn McKay Brody, one of 20th century Mormondom's most famous dissidents, reviled by many of Mormondom's faithful as passionately as her father, David O., is adored. Such negative Mormon feelings toward Fawn Brody are nurtured in large measure by her controversial biography of Joseph Smith, No Man Knows My History, which presents the Mormon prophet from a naturalistic perspective, that is, as primarily motivated by non-religious or secular considerations. Brody, moreover, remained a quintessential critic of things Mormon throughout the rest of her life. In terms of her background, Fawn McKay Brody seemed most unlikely to assume the role of Mormon dissident. Fawn McKay came from patrician Mormon stock. Her paternal grandfather, David McKay, helped found Huntsville. Her father, Thomas McKay, a respected church leader, served twice as president of the Swiss-German mission and as president of the Ogden Stake for 19 years. Later, he was ordained an assistant to the Quorum of the Twelve. His older brother, and hence Fawn's uncle, David O. McKay, was already a member of the Quorum of the Twelve when Fawn was born. On her mother's side, Fawn's grandfather, George H. Brimhall, served as president of Brigham Young University. The future dissident, moreover, fondly recalled her formative years in Huntsville as an idyllic childhood. She described the family farmhouse as a great place to grow up, and Huntsville itself as a place she loved madly. In her childhood behavior, Fawn was obedient and deeply religious. Fawn recalled that she had been a supremely good and obedient child. Fawn asserted the virtues of obedience in her first published work, a poem entitled Just a Minute, Mother, written at age 10. Appearing in the Mormon Church children's periodical The Juvenile Instructor in 1925, Fawn's poem asserted, "Just a minute, Mother, is heard in all child's homes, from the cottage of the peasants to the castles with great domes. If mothers tried to count the just a minutes of each day, we'd find that hours and hours had slipped uselessly away. Let's drop our just a minutes and make our mothers smile. And in this time we've wasted, do something that's worthwhile." Fawn was religiously active as well. She taught a Sunday school class and frequently spoke or gave poetry readings in church. Much of her recreation centered around the Huntsville Ward's youth group, known as the Builders Club. Spiritually, she manifested strong belief. In a particular fast and testimony meeting, Fawn got up and bore a beautiful testimony, asserting the truthfulness of the restored gospel, according to the recollections of her younger brother. On another occasion, in December 1931, Fawn asserted her strong spirituality in a Christmas story given to a student devotional at Weber College, then a two-year institution run by the Mormon Church. Fawn's story, The Great Rushing of Wings, described the struggle and hardship of a poor, impoverished, widowed mother whose child had been born without the use of his limbs. However, after suffering much misfortune and as the result of a divinely inspired Christmas miracle, the crippled child gained full use of his limbs. The Great Rushing of Wings concluded, "The voice of the priest was hoarse and trembling. A miracle indeed, my son, a blessed miracle of faith. Blessed are the pure in heart," he whispered, "for they shall see God." Thus, Fawn's basic spirituality appeared to wax strong throughout her formative years. According to Fawn's later recollections, "I was devout until I went to the University of Utah." There were, however, indications of Fawn's future descent long before her 1932 departure to Salt Lake City. These stem from certain tensions and conflicts, including inner conflicts, that is, those related to the author's own behavior and attitudes, as well as external conflicts involving her family and the environment in which she lived. Inner conflicts stemmed in large measure from Fawn's superior intelligence and her physical appearance. The second of five children, Fawn demonstrated her exceptional intelligence at as early as age three through her ability to memorize and recite lengthy pieces of poetry. By the time she was four, Fawn was able to read fourth grade level books with ease. At age six, when formally enrolled in school, the principal immediately advanced the bright six-year-old to the third grade. She was subsequently advanced two more grades. When she reached high school, she excelled in public speaking and debate. Fawn's precocity, however, was not without a price. Because she was 3 to 4 years younger than most of her classmates, she was socially quite insecure and reticent. Exacerbating Fawn's basic shyness was an extreme sensitivity about her physical appearance. Despite being strikingly beautiful to all who knew her, Fawn looked upon herself in a different light. She was almost painfully shy about her height. She reached 5'10" height as a young adolescent, which made her taller than all of the girls and most of the boys her age. As Fawn continued to grow, tears would flow, for in Fawn's eyes, tall girls were not popular. Also setting the stage for Fawn's descent were the differing religious views of her father and mother. Fawn described her mother as a kind of quiet heretic, which made it easier for me. Her mother's heresy, Fawn recalled, was very quiet and took the form mostly of encouraging me in a quiet way to be on my own. By contrast, her father was very devout. Such parental tensions made for some family difficulties. These difficulties, moreover, were further complicated by the strained relationship between Fawn and her father. There was limited communication while growing up, resulting in a complete absence of dialogue between the two. Whenever Fawn would attempt to raise questions concerning her religious doubts, the only thing her father would say was, "You've got to believe." We both found it impossible to communicate on the subject, Fawn later remembered, attributing this lack of communication to a McKay family tendency to avoid any and all unpleasant subjects. Thus, when Fawn arrived at the arrived in Salt Lake City to attend the University of Utah, she experienced a quiet kind of moving out of the parochialism of the Mormon community. Fawn began doubting the strong ties that she had with the church. Facilitating this process were the various courses and professors to which she was exposed at the University of Utah, an institution which Fawn described as the seat of anti-clericalism in Utah. Also, while at the university, Fawn encountered for the first time a vast body of non- and anti-Mormon literature, presenting the Latter-day Saints in a less than heroic light. Despite her emerging dissent, Fawn did not discuss her growing doubts with her father or any other family member. Instead, she returned to Ogden and Weber College to teach English. In the meantime, she became romantically involved with Dilworth Jensen, whom she had known for many years while growing up in Huntsville. Fawn's growing dissent, however, caused problems. Dilworth's commitment to Mormonism was much stronger, having served for 2.5 years in the Swiss-German mission. He became very frustrated and worried, observing Fawn's growing problems with church history and doctrine. At the same time, Fawn became increasingly concerned about hers and Dilworth's religious compatibility. A potential impasse was averted when Fawn's older sister, Flora, eloped with Dilworth Jensen's older brother, Leslie. The McKays apparently feared that Fawn and Dilworth might follow their course, and so Fawn and her parents mutually agreed that Fawn would not go to Berkeley, but would instead attend graduate school at the University of Chicago. Fawn's departure for Chicago was a major turning point in her evolution as a dissenter. Living away from Utah for the first time, she rarely recalled, quote, "The confining aspects of the Mormon religion dropped off within a few weeks. It was like taking off a hot coat in the summertime. The sense of liberation I had at the University of Chicago was enormously exhilarating. I felt very quickly that I could never go back to the old life, and I never did." In turn, Fawn completely severed her relationship with Dilworth Jensen after meeting Bernard Brody, a fellow graduate student from Chicago who came from a Latvian Jewish background. She married Brody after a whirlwind courtship of just 6 weeks on the 25th of August, 1936. Shortly thereafter, the new Mrs. Brody began serious historical research into Mormon history, research which would ultimately result in her biography of Joseph Smith. Some debate has emerged as to exactly why Brody chose to undertake her controversial study of Mormonism's founder. Brody herself ventured several possible motives. On the one hand, she confessed that her biography, quote, "served for me what the autobiographical novel usually does for the young novelist," unquote. That is, as a kind of catharsis. Elaborating on this point, she stated, "But there was a compulsion to self-expression too, as well as a compulsion to liberate myself wholly from Mormonism and perhaps certain family relationships." On another occasion, she described the writing of the biography as a desperate effort to come to terms with my childhood. Still later, Brody indicated the influence of her Jewish non-Mormon husband, Bernard. She characterized her research as an attempt to answer the questions of her husband, who was totally new to the Mormon scene. In doing this, she had started out not to write a biography of Joseph Smith, but instead to write a short article about the sources of the Book of Mormon. However, as she pursued her research, she found that there was no good biography of Joseph Smith, and so undertook the task herself. Finally, Brody ventured still another possible motive, her role as a dissenter writing for other dissenters. "It was a rather compulsive thing I had to. It was partly I wanted to answer a lot of questions for myself. There were many questions that no one had answered for me. I certainly did not get any of the answers in Utah. Having discovered the answers and being excited about them, I felt I wanted to give other young, doubting Mormons a chance to see the evidence." Brody's No Man Knows My History stimulated a variety of reactions following its publication in late 1945, ranging from applause to attack. Applause came mainly from writers and commentators based outside of Utah, particularly on the East Coast, where her book had been published, whereas attack was mainly focused in Utah, coming primarily from individuals and publications identified with the Mormon Church. The most potent attack from within official Mormondom occurred in June 1946 with Fawn McKay Brody's formal excommunication from the Church. In her official Church summons, Brody was charged with apostasy. Quote, "You assert matters as truths which deny the divine origin of the Book of Mormon, the restoration of the priesthood, and of Christ's Church through the instrumentality of the prophet Joseph Smith, contrary to the beliefs, doctrines, and teachings of the Church," unquote. Thus, in the eyes of Mormon Church officials, Fawn Brody was no longer a mere Latter-day Saint dissenter, but henceforth a heretic banished beyond the pale of Mormondom. Despite her formal excommunication, Brody remained a quintessential critic of Mormondom, whose views were expressed in essays appearing in various national publications. In fact, in April 1946, just prior to her excommunication, Brody had produced a highly critical essay entitled "Polygamy Shocks the Mormons," which appeared in the American Mercury. Brody's essay was written in response to the arrest, conviction, and imprisonment of 15 fundamentalist Mormons by Utah law enforcement officers in June 1944. Brody condemned this this action taken with the full support of Latter-day Saint authorities, characterizing it as, quote, a strange reversal or curious evolution in that Utah Mormondom was as united against the fundamentalists as it had been united back in the 19th century in defending polygamy and defying the United States government to uphold the peculiar Mormon practice. A year later, in July 1947, on the centennial of Brigham Young's entry into the Great Salt Lake Valley, Brody wrote a second essay published in the New York Times entitled, "This is the Place, and It Became Utah." Brody's essay started out with a brief, generally conventional historical overview of the changes that had affected both Utah and the Mormon Church in the 100 years since 1847. But then she characterized the church organization as strictly authoritarian, and the leaders, tenacious alike in their traditions and of their power, exhorting their people to be, first of all, obedient. Then Brody pointed out the irony of this situation. But if obedience, she said, to ecclesiastical authority is the primary law of the church, a belief in human perfectibility is its loftiest theological ideal. Then, clearly alluding to the origins and evolution of her own dissent, Brody concluded, quote, "There results, therefore, an unceasing conflict between uncompromising fundamentalism on the one hand and the eager striving for perfection, which is the basis of Mormon educational philosophy. For the very education of which Mormonism is so proud breeds skepticism and often outright rejection of Mormon doctrine," unquote. As a quintessential critic of Mormondom, Brody was particularly bothered by Mormon-black relations. She spoke out against the now-defunct policy of excluding blacks from the priesthood. In No Man Knows My History, she was the first to speak out on the negative nature of Mormonism's exclusionary black policy, characterizing it as the ugliest thesis in existing Mormon theology. Also, she was the first to probe the origins of this practice, placing it within a social historical framework, thereby helping to strip away the religious myth and mystery surrounding this practice, which in turn helped to undermine its doctrinal legitimacy. Throughout the 1950s and into the 1960s, Brody continued to speak out as the church itself found itself under increased fire. In September 1970, Brody confronted this issue in a public address, "Can We Manipulate the Past?", given in the Lafayette Ballroom of the Mormon Church-owned Hotel Utah to a standing-room-only crowd of over 500. Brody asserted that the Mormon Church for years had been manipulating or misreading its past in order to justify its policy of black priesthood denial. Finally, 8 years later, in June 1978, Brody enjoyed some satisfaction when at long last the Mormon Church lifted its ban against black priesthood denial. Ironically enough, Brody herself was in Salt Lake City at the time, proclaiming it a great day to be there. Such satisfaction, however, was short-lived, for just 2 years later, in September 1980, Fawn Brody was diagnosed with cancer, this coming on the heels of her husband Bernard's death in November 1978 from the same malady. By late 1980, Brody's own condition worsened and became critical, requiring hospitalization. In the meantime, two stories circulated concerning Fawn's past and present relationship to the Mormon Church. The first suggested that Brody herself, in the immediate aftermath of the appearance of No Man Knows My History back in 1946, had specifically asked to be excommunicated from the Mormon Church. Thus, church officials, in purging her name from church roles, were merely acquiescing to her request. This, of course, was untrue. A second story circulating in early 1981 was that Brody had asked to be rebaptized back into the church. In fact, versions of this story had circulated since the publication of No Man Knows My History. This story was given impetus by a hospital visit to the ailing author by her brother, Thomas B. McKay, in late December 1980. According to Brody's own account, quote, "I was very glad to see Thomas and asked for a blessing, as my father had communicated blessings over the years as a kind of family patriarch. This blessing he gave me, and I told him I was grateful, saying he had said what I wanted him to say," unquote. Brody's account, however, revealed lingering inner conflict. Quote, "My delight in asking for an opportunity for a blessing at that moment indicated simply the intensity of an old hunger." But then she carefully added, "Any exaggeration about my request for a blessing, meaning I was asking to be taken back into the church at that moment, I strictly repudiate and would for all time." A few days later, on the 10th of January 1981, Fawn Brody died at age 65. And in accordance with her wishes, her body was cremated and the ashes scattered over the Santa Monica Mountains near Pacific Palisades, where she had spent the last 30 years of her life. Thus, Fawn McKay Brody affirmed her position as a dissenter, albeit with ambivalence, right up to the end. In conclusion, the question that must be asked is, what is the place of Fawn Brody as a dissident historian and a critic of Mormonism? There are, of course, sharply differing views on this point among many Orthodox, devout Mormons. She is viewed as in a completely negative light, as a sort of female Judas Iscariot who betrayed her birthright in an attempt to destroy the image of Mormonism's founder, thereby undermining the basic foundations of Mormonism itself. By contrast, among the more open-minded, Brody is viewed much more positively. Sterling M. McMurrin, himself a well-known Mormon critic, views Fawn Brody as the facilitator of a new climate of liberation. Because of No Man Knows My History, Mormon history produced by Mormon scholars has moved toward more openness, objectivity, and honesty, unquote. Whatever the case, it is clear that Fawn McKay Brody was 20th century Mormonism's most noteworthy dissenting female historian and quintessential critic.
It was very gratifying to see all of you here this morning, given the uncertain and cloudy religious environment that we have found ourselves in since the last symposium. I think your presence here symbolizes a triumph and a freedom of the human spirit. Over the last several months, as new editor of Dialogue and recently resigned editor for the Journal of Mormon History, I've had the pleasure of reading two or three other manuscripts by Mr. Bringhurst regarding Fawn Brody and others he describes as dissidents. I say pleasure because on the whole I have found these manuscripts to be clearly written, informative, insightful, and even balanced, unlike the response comments you'll hear from me now. Bringhurst's papers caused me to reflect on my own introduction to Fawn Brody, a person I regret I never met. As a young student, I recall learning of her book, No Man Knows My History, being interested in Mormon history, and being advised by one in authority to avoid it like a plague. It had been written by a woman in her late 20s, I was told, who had exploited her family connections with David O. McKay, gotten access to sensitive materials in the church archives, and then betrayed her church, portraying Joseph Smith in a very negative light. As an Orthodox follower at the time, I exercised my free agency and manifested my faith by not reading the book. Years later, as a more serious student of Mormon history, I read the book and other writings of Brody and found why many consider them to be standard works of the so-called New Mormon History. I will confide to you up front that I consider this to be a valuable paper, especially the longer version, for it treats an important person at an especially important time. I have made my response in the form of rough notes, which I'll refer to throughout the response. My remarks are as much a personal essay as they are a scholarly response, for I find little to criticize in terms of the paper's scholarship. In fact, as one of my first official acts of dialogue, I'd like to ask Newell to consider submitting his manuscript. And moreover, I advise the author to gather up all his Brodie papers, fill in the gaps, and publish a full Brodie biography. I believe that Mr. Bringhurst has answered the key questions each of us might pose regarding Brodie's intellectual life, her motivations, and the reasons for her dissent. I wish we could find a more value-neutral, less one-sidedly judgmental set of terms to use regarding people like Fawn Brodie. We use terms, or the church does, like heretic, apostate, dissenter, unfaithful, inactive, and so forth, to define those who consciously and for good reasons and motivated by intellectual integrity choose other paths which they find to be more illuminated with the light of truth. I think a key question for us this morning is, what can we learn from Fawn Brodie's story? She was clearly a founder and leader of the more scholarly, multidisciplinary, and objective historiography that, as I mentioned, some call the New Mormon history. But despite the fact that her career in this area began in the 40s and continued through the late 70s, her issues then are really the same as those we face today. Her journey was a classic, prototypical one, and has been followed by many others, including what we might call the Lost Generation II, people of our own time. From the church's standpoint, if the goal is to keep its brightest, most thoughtful, sensitive, and creative members, and I'm not convinced that there's evidence that this is the goal, these members seem to be most expendable, as Fawn Brodie was. But if it is the goal, then the church should learn that strong Mormon families and early obedience and orthodoxy do not guarantee later activity in a repressed intellectual environment wherein history is hidden, distorted, or otherwise manipulated. In an effort to protect the weak from historical anomalies, doctrinal contradictions, the church partly succeeds. It keeps the weak, who are unreflective, uncritical, and not possessed of a thirst for truth, and thus not committed to the advancement of Mormon life and culture through progressive change wrought by greater knowledge. But in its so-called protection of the weak, it willingly sacrifices the strong, those who could have offered so much had the church been worthy of their sustained commitment. On the other hand, from the viewpoint of the dissenter, once enough knowledge is obtained to determine that the church in many important categories is not what it represents itself to be, as Fawn Brodie determined, a sense of betrayal sets in, leading to an inevitable course of exposure of the difficulties, criticism, and an effort to demythologize the church so that others will not be hurt, as Fawn Brodie was. Like many who once deeply believed in and cared for the church, Brodie carried her pain like a cross and took her hurt to the grave. What pathos to ask for a priesthood blessing near the end of her life, only to have the church twist and manipulate the story to discredit her career in an effort to sustain its own position. I say that Brodie's journey was inevitable because she was a person not only of great intellect, but of inviolable integrity. She remained connected to the church as a critic because she believed that pushing for reform was not only legitimate, it was, in her words, an imperative. It was her way of contributing to and trying to strengthen the church. She could have washed her hands of the church and left it to its own devices. She must have been tempted many times to do so. But it took more courage and showed more commitment to whatever is good in Mormonism to stay and fight for a better, more open, more honest, more humane church, one worthy of the devotion it demands. Why else would she have continued for 40 years after her loss of faith to expend many of her finest energies on promoting such a variety of reforms as objective history, reversing the priesthood discrimination against the blacks policy, and instituting more equal representation and rights for women, among a host of others? These are all progressive, constructive proposals. If adopted, and some of them have been and others may be, They would strengthen rather than destroy the church and its members. I do not believe that Brody's intent ever was to destroy Mormonism, as she has been accused of trying to do. Though she had been deceived, betrayed, and hurt by it, she remained involved in attempts to better it. People's hurt is in proportion to their caring. She hurt deeply because she cared deeply, especially for the people whom she loved till the end. She cared enough to try to prevent or at least soften their hurt. Brody's example will increasingly be seen as heroic by those who value truth over obedience, growth and progress over maintaining the status quo, intellectual integrity and humanity over blind faith, manipulation, and coerciveness. When she half-jokingly labeled herself, quote, the leading female Judas Iscariot, unquote, she perhaps mindfully used a metaphor the church would find apt. Modern interpretations portray Judas as, if not high-minded, at least well-intended, not a selfishly motivated betrayer and a devil's pawn. But church institutions need devils and Judases and antichrists and apostates and insubordinates, the new word applied recently to church employees who would disobey counsel and attend this symposium. These anti-heroes serve the simplistic purpose of maintaining the black and white color scheme used as a model of universal reality. The darker the black, the brighter the white, by comparison. Fawn Brody found, through her research and exposure to diverse ideas, another truer model, one more consistent with historical facts and her own life's experiences. Initially, the result of her intellectual awakening was a tendency to reverse the limited spectrum, that is, to call the black white and the white black, merely to change the cowboy hats. Fortunately, wise friends like Dale Morgan, Claire Noel, Wilfred Paulson, and Juanita Brooks helped her to see that simply taking the opposite extreme might be equally incomplete and unreal in its own way. Brody would find the greater truths that lay hidden in the complex gray areas. Her eventual balance led to her credibility. The church's response to her work is as predictable as it is lamentable. If I could encourage the author to expand any part of his treatment, it would be to give more detail to Brody's disfellowshipment and excommunication. Are there more extensive accounts on either side as to what occurred? What specific accusations and charges were made, and with what evidence? And what defense, if any, was offered? What role did David O. McKay and other powerful members of the family play? If we can learn anything from Brody's life, it is that despite her gallant efforts, nothing much has changed. Institutional closed-mindedness and intellectual harassment, persecution, and punishment persist. Archives are increasingly restricted, and honest inquiry is discouraged, as is independent discussion and writing on religious topics. Strong contributing members are still expendable. The environment of hostility is experienced as almost inquisitional by some, and incidents of spiritual abuse seem to be on the increase. As in Brody's time, a few courageous persons still care enough to speak out against the negatives and in favor of positive reform. Brody would undoubtedly be disappointed, but not surprised, by the suppressive situation today. I compliment the author, Newell Bringhurst, for his clear, understandable presentation of Brody's inner life, her motivations and works. I know that he brings to his work the sympathy and respect that any biographer has for his or her subject. I have also learned from reading the author's other papers on Brody that the author's own journey has paralleled hers in significant ways, increasing the author's sensitivity to the subject. In fact, it may be that over-sympathy results in some lack of critical evaluation of her work. But my own journey, and that of many of my friends and associates, also closely resembles Brody. I see her as a different kind of Mormon pioneer, an intellectual and reformist pioneer. And as a product of the 60s, I revere her work despite the shortcomings of the psychobiographic method. It has been said, probably by an intellectual, that intellectuals always win out in the end. I have often pondered whether this is true. What is true is that many become unappreciated martyrs at the hands of the church and are rejected, spiritually exiled, and forced to live ignominious lives, always viewed suspiciously as tainted persons by the Orthodox, including close family members. If Brody's life and works are to remain meaningful, we must help to make them so by honoring her intent and continuing to insist as members on a restoration of basic rights and virtues. To not do so is to continue to wage a lose-lose war with mounting casualties on both sides. Individuals lose as they are betrayed, disillusioned, respond by trying to identify and correct problems, and are disciplined for, quote, interfering with the mission of the church, unquote. The church loses many of its finest members, plus their children and their children's children through the generations. The church loses the many contributions all of these people and the people lose the spiritual benefits of membership. There is another, harder to define, more existential loss felt by both sides. It has to do with the ruination of the souls of both institutions and individuals as they exhaust their energies on battling each other rather than concentrating on larger global needs such as hunger, poverty, health, literacy, and peace. We not only lose the effort we could have expended on basic Christian ministries by focusing on ideological welfare, we canker our souls and ignore the millions whose fundamental human needs go perpetually unsatisfied. The fight for better thinking must go on until it is won, but we must remember that even greater callings await. I applaud Mr. Bringhurst for his fine work and hope that he will continue to highlight Fawn Brody, her aims and accomplishments, so that she may serve as a signal torch, a sort of alternate title of liberty, as others of us try to follow in her footsteps by advancing the essential virtues of the church through Christ-like reform. Let us continue to support, as Sterling McMurrin mentioned in his comments on Brody, a new climate of liberation. Thank you.